This is Chapter 11, Part 2, read by Len Bertain. Bonnie huddled with her boss, Roland, for a minute or two before answering the question. Finally, she said, "We don't have any firm sales projections at this moment on this new product. We have signed one order with a major heating and air conditioning manufacturer. We're now negotiating with two others. Both Roland and I think that this pump and valve assembly is going to be a big seller. It eliminates the need for a separate control valve for each pump. I'll have some projected sales figures for you in the morning." Everyone was getting ready to leave, and Dr. Elby said, "Wait just a minute. Class isn't over yet. I have one thing to go over with you before you leave. Did you know that you learned something today that I was going to teach you tomorrow? I was going to teach you the five whys. Does anyone know anything about the five whys?" No one responded. Dr. Elby went on. "Taichi Ono, the developer of the Toyota production system, said that the answer to all problems can be determined by the time you come up with the fifth why. You might recall that I interrogated Bernard about why he shouldn't move to the shop floor. By the second why, we realized that Bernard did not have a good reason and that we should investigate it further. The same thing applies to any other problem. For example, Jim was telling me about a problem that he had with someone who tripped over a hose and got hurt. He asked the first why. The answer, of course, was that one of the workers was using the air hose to blow off a machine. The second why revealed that the worker using the hose didn't have a hose on his side of the aisle. The third why led to because there was no airline near his work area. At that point, the answer is, why not put an airline near his work area? The answer was obtained by the third why. So your homework assignment is to practice the five whys today and forever. The purpose of doing this is to get to the root cause of the problem. We need the real reason that we have a problem, and the five whys will help us get there. Remember, this is just like a two-year-old asking you why. Whenever I've worked with people and they know the five whys, I never have to ask the second why. They know the next one's coming, and so they try to come up with a solution quickly. This is really looking for the root cause of the problem. Most people hate to hear the second why. Anyway, have a good day, everyone. That's the end of the reading of Chapter 11. The following are Chapter 11 insights. So how do you know that you've identified a good waste to work on? In the December 2001 issue of Fast Company magazine, Tom Peters made an observation that I have been using in the War on Waste project since I started in 1985. Peters observed that good ideas come from someone who was pissed about something. In his perception, things only happen in the world when someone is angry about the status quo. Martin Luther was angry about 95 theses, or 95 issues that he had with the Catholic Church. This anger led to the Protestant Reformation. Similar situations in which discontent has led to significant change, even transformation, have happened throughout history. In Peter's view and in mine, just about every major business improvement occurs for the same reason, because someone is angry about something. What we've noticed during the War on Waste is that if someone is angry about a part of his or her job, then there is usually a waste associated with that. In one company, three teams in a particular class were rolling along nicely with good wastes that needed to be eliminated. At the fourth table, the team was just sitting there, not talking. So I went over to them and asked what was going on. The informal spokesman said that no one wanted to contribute. So I asked him if he did. He said, sure, but he wasn't going to go it alone. I said, I understood. Out of the blue, I asked him, does anything in your job piss you off? Immediately responded, of course, he said. I get really mad when I have to change a setup to run a rush job or hot job that is still sitting around days later. About that time, the CEO came in. He pointed out that they had solved that hot job problem a couple of months ago. I pointed out that it didn't sound like it. I gave him a yellow ruled pad and directed him to go out with the team and write down all jobs still sitting in the shop that were hot 2 weeks ago. The hot jobs had red tags, so they were easy to find. After 15 minutes, the CEO and the team came back with a page full of stalled hot jobs. Apparently, the problem had not been solved. The team now had their project, and it turned out to be a pretty good one because the CEO was now firmly engaged and committed to make it work. It turns out that this problem was a good example of tribal knowledge gone amok. The scheduler loved to respond to crises, and he and the shop foreman had an unwritten understanding that all jobs identified as priorities by the CEO would be introduced in the schedule to meet the targeted deadline. They did this knowing full well that the consequence would be the problem identified by the team noted above. In the course of this analysis, this fact was discovered, and it took a good deal of coercion to get them to admit how they did the scheduling. And it turned out that the cause of their procedure was a memo from the CEO that all hot jobs would meet their delivery date. So these two guys changed the procedure themselves so that the CEO would not yell at them. The message here is that once secretive tribal knowledge is uncovered, unless there is a no-blame release of finger-pointing, the path to a clean solution is difficult. We got the scheduler and the shop foreman to become part of the solution by contributing ideas to the team. The end result was getting to the root cause of the problem and a complete change in the scheduling of jobs. I would like to make a comment here about the CEO who caused the creation of the problem in the first place. When we dig into sources of many of these tribal knowledge wastes, they have their roots in casual comments of the CEO. The CEO might say something like, gee, that looks like an expensive way to do that. Or, why are all those hot jobs not making it to the floor? We saw the way the second comment created the problem discussed in this chapter. The CEO was responsible for the hot jobs problem from a comment that he inadvertently made to the foreman and scheduler. In a funny story with an associate of mine experienced, a CEO asked him to find out why production process had slowed down so much. Upon investigation, it took my friend about 15 minutes to find the problem. It turned out that the CEO had made a casual comment about spending too much on something, and so the CFO instituted a process to make sure that he saw all POs, and the sales vice president had to get a copy as well. And it took forever for an order to hit the floor from receipt and sales. My advice to CEOs when they walk the floor is, be careful and be quiet. That's the end of chapter 11.